Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Chapter 6 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Swine Things. It was an evening, a week later. My sister sat in the garden knitting. I was walking up and down reading. My gun leant up against the wall of the house, for since the advent of that strange thing in the gardens, I had deemed it wise to take precautions. Yet, through the whole week, there had been nothing to alarm me, either by sight or sound, so that I was able to look back calmly to the incident, though still with a sense of unmitigated wonder and curiosity. I was, as I have just said, walking up and down and somewhat engrossed in my book. Suddenly I heard a crash, away in the direction of the pit. With a quick movement, I turned and saw a tremendous column of dust rising high into the evening air. My sister had risen to her feet with a sharp exclamation of surprise and fright. Telling her to stay where she was, I snatched up my gun and ran toward the pit. As I neared it, I heard a dull, rumbling sound that grew quickly into a roar, split with deeper crashes, and up from the pit drove a fresh volume of dust. The noise ceased. Though the dust still rose tumultuously, I reached the edge and looked down, but could see nothing save a boil of dust clouds swirling hither and thither. The air was so full of the small particles that they blinded and choked me, and finally I had to run out from the smother to breathe. Gradually the suspended matter sank and hung in a panoply over the mouth of the pit. I could only guess at what had happened. That there had been a landslip of some kind, I had little doubt, but the cause was beyond my knowledge, and yet, even then, I had half imaginings, for already the thought had come to me of those falling rocks and the thing in the bottom of the pit. But in the first minutes of confusion, I failed to reach the natural conclusion to which the catastrophe pointed. Slowly the dust subsided until presently I was able to approach the edge and look down. For a while I peered impotently, trying to see through the reek. At first it was impossible to make out anything. Then, as I stared, I saw something below to my left that moved. I looked intently toward it, and presently made out another, and then another. Three dim shapes that appeared to be climbing up the side of the pit. I could see them only indistinctly. Even as I stared in wonder, I heard a rattle of stones somewhere to my right. I glanced across, but could see nothing. I leant forward and peered over and down into the pit, just beneath where I stood, and saw no further than a hideous white swine face that had risen to within a couple of yards of my feet. Below it I could make out several others. As the thing saw me, it gave a sudden uncouth squeal, which was answered from all parts of the pit. At that, a gust of horror and fear took me, and bending down, I discharged my gun right into its face. Straightway the creature disappeared with a clatter of loose earth and stones. There was a momentary silence, to which probably I owe my life, for during it I heard a quick patter of many feet, and turning sharply, saw a troop of the creatures coming toward me at a run. Instantly I raised my gun and fired at the foremost, who plunged headlong with a hideous howling. Then I turned to run. More than halfway from the house to the pit I saw my sister. She was coming toward me. I could not see her face distinctly, as the dusk had fallen, but there was fear in her voice as she called to know why I was shooting. "Run!" I shouted in reply. "Run for your life!" Without more ado she turned and fled, picking up her skirts with both hands. As I followed I gave a glance behind. The brutes were running on their hind legs, at times dropping on all fours. I think it must have been the terror in my voice that spurred Mary to run so, for I feel convinced that she had not as yet seen those hell creatures that pursued. On we went, my sister leading. Each moment the nearing sounds of the footsteps told me that the brutes were gaining on us rapidly. Fortunately, I am accustomed to live in some ways an active life. As it was, the strain of the race was beginning to tell severely upon me. Ahead I could see the back door. Luckily it was open. I was some half dozen yards behind Mary now, and my breath was sobbing in my throat. Then something touched my shoulder. I wrenched my head round quickly and saw one of those monstrous pallid faces close to mine. One of the creatures, having outrun its companions, had almost overtaken me. Even as I turned, it made a fresh grab. With a sudden effort I sprang to one side, and swinging my gun by the barrel, brought it crashing down upon the foul creature's head. The thing dropped with an almost human groan. Even this short delay had been nearly sufficient to bring the rest of the brutes down upon me, so that without an instant's waste of time I turned and ran for the door. Reaching it, I burst into the passage, then turning quickly slammed and bolted the door, just as the first of the creatures rushed against it with a sudden shock. My sister sat gasping in a chair. She seemed in a fainting condition, but I had no time then to spend on her. I had to make sure that all the doors were fastened. Fortunately, they were. The one leading from my study into the gardens was the last to which I went. I had just had time to note that it was secured when I thought I heard a noise outside. I stood perfectly silent and listened. Yes. Now I could distinctly hear a sound of whispering, and something slithered over the panels with a rasping, scratchy noise. Evidently some of the brutes were feeling with their claw hands about the door to discover whether there were any means of ingress. That the creatures should so soon have found the door was, to me, a proof of their reasoning capabilities. It assured me that they must not be regarded by any means as mere animals. I had felt something of this before, when that first thing peered in through my window. Then I had applied the term superhuman to it, with an almost instinctive knowledge that the creature was something different from the brute beast. Something beyond human, yet in no good sense, but rather as something foul and hostile to the great and good in humanity. In a word, as something intelligent and yet inhuman. The very thought of the creatures filled me with revulsion. Now I bethought me of my sister, and going to the cupboard I got out a flask of brandy and a wine-glass. Taking these, I went down to the kitchen, carrying a lighted candle with me. She was not sitting in the chair, but had fallen out, and was lying upon the floor face downward. Very gently I turned her over and raised her head somewhat. Then I poured a little of the brandy between her lips. After a while she shivered slightly. A little later she gave several gasps and opened her eyes. In a dreamy, unrealizing way she looked at me. Then her eyes closed slowly, and I gave her a little more of the brandy. For perhaps a minute longer she lay silent, breathing quickly. All at once her eyes opened again, and it seemed to me, as I looked, that the pupils were dilated, as though fear had come with returning consciousness. Then, with a movement so unexpected that I started backward, she sat up. Noticing that she seemed giddy, I put out my hand to steady her. At that she gave a loud scream, and, scrambling to her feet, ran from the room. For a moment I stayed there, kneeling and holding the brandy flask. I was utterly puzzled and astonished. Could she be afraid of me? But no. Why should she be? I could only conclude that her nerves were badly shaken, and that she was temporarily unhinged. Upstairs I heard a door bang, loudly, and I knew that she had taken refuge in her room. I put the flask down on the table. My attention was distracted by a noise in the direction of the back door. I went toward it and listened. It appeared to be shaken as though some of the creatures struggled with it silently, but it was far too strongly constructed and hung to be easily moved. Out in the gardens rose a continuous sound. It might have been mistaken by a casual listener for the grunting and squealing of a herd of pigs, but as I stood there, it came to me that there was sense and meaning to all those swinish noises. Gradually I seemed able to trace a semblance in it to human speech, gluttonous and sticky, as though each articulation were made with difficulty. Yet nevertheless I was becoming convinced that it was no mere medley of sounds, but a rapid interchange of ideas. By this time it had grown quite dark in the passages, and from these came all the varied cries and groans of which an old house is so full after nightfall. It is no doubt because things are then quieter and one has more leisure to hear. Also, there may be something in the theory that the sudden change of temperature at sundown affects the structure of the house somewhat, causing it to contract and settle, as it were, for the night. However, this is as may be, but on that night in particular I would gladly have been quit of so many eerie noises. It seemed to me that each crack and creak was the coming of one of those things along the dark corridors, though I knew in my heart that this could not be, for I had seen myself that all the doors were secure. Gradually, however, these sounds grew on my nerves to such an extent that, were it only to punish my cowardice, I felt I must make the round of the basement again, and if anything were there, face it. And then I would go up to my study, for I knew sleep was out of the question, with the house surrounded by creatures, half beasts, half something else, and entirely unholy. Taking the kitchen lamp down from its hook, I made my way from cellar to cellar, and room to room, through pantry and coal hole, along passages, and into the 101 little blind alleys and hidden nooks that form the basement of the old house. Then, when I knew I had been in every corner and cranny large enough to conceal aught of any size, I made my way to the stairs. With my foot on the first step, I paused. It seemed to me I heard a movement apparently from the buttery, which is to the left of the staircase. It had been one of the first places I searched, and yet I felt certain my ears had not deceived me. My nerves were strung now, and with hardly any hesitation I stepped up to the door, holding the lamp above my head. In a glance I saw that the place was empty, save for the heavy stone slabs supported by brick pillars, and I was about to leave it, convinced that I had been mistaken, when in turning my light was flashed back from two bright spots outside the window and high up. For a few moments I stood there staring. Then they moved, revolving slowly and throwing out alternate scintillations of green and red. At least so it appeared to me. I knew then that they were eyes. Slowly I traced the shadowy outline of one of the things. It appeared to be holding on to the bars of the window, and its attitude suggested climbing. I went nearer to the window and held the light higher. There was no need to be afraid of the creature. The bars were strong, and there was little danger of its being able to move them. And then suddenly, in spite of the knowledge that the brute could not reach to harm me, I had a return of the horrible sensation of fear that had assailed me on that night, a week previously. It was the same feeling of helpless, shuddering fright. I realized dimly that the creature's eyes were looking into mine with a steady, compelling stare. I tried to turn away, but could not. I seemed now to see the window through a mist. Then I thought other eyes came and peered, and yet others, until a whole galaxy of malignant, staring orbs seemed to hold me in thrall. My head began to swim and throb violently. Then I was aware of a feeling of acute physical pain in my left hand. It grew more severe and forced, literally forced, my attention. With a tremendous effort, I glanced down, and with that the spell that had held me was broken. I realized then that I had, in my agitation, unconsciously caught hold of the hot lamp-glass and burnt my hand badly. I looked up to the window again. The misty appearance had gone, and now I saw that it was crowded with dozens of bestial faces. With a sudden access of rage, I raised the lamp and hurled it full at the window. It struck the glass, smashing a pane, and passed between two of the bars out into the garden, scattering burning oil as it went. I heard several loud cries of pain, and as my sight became accustomed to the dark, I discovered that the creatures had left the window. Pulling myself together, I groped for the door, and having found it, made my way upstairs, stumbling at each step. I felt dazed, as though I had received a blow on the head. At the same time, my hand smarted badly, and I was full of a nervous, dull rage against those things. Reaching my study, I lit the candles. As they burnt up, their rays were reflected from the rack of firearms on the sidewall. At the sight, I remembered that I had there a power, which, as I had proved earlier, seemed as fatal to those monsters as to more ordinary animals, and I determined I would take the offensive. First of all, I bound up my hand, for the pain was fast becoming intolerable. After that, it seemed easier, and I crossed the room to the rifle stand. There I selected a heavy rifle, an old and tried weapon, and having procured ammunition, I made my way up into one of the small towers with which the house is crowned. From there I found that I could see nothing. The gardens presented a dim blur of shadows, a little blacker, perhaps, where the trees stood. That was all, and I knew that it was useless to shoot down into all that darkness. The only thing to be done was to wait for the moon to rise. Then I might be able to do a little execution. In the meantime, I sat still and kept my ears open. The gardens were comparatively quiet now, and only an occasional grunt or squeal came up to me. I did not like this silence. It made me wonder on what devilry the creatures were bent. Twice I left the tower and took a walk through the house, but everything was silent. Once I heard a noise from the direction of the pit as though more earth had fallen. Following this, and lasting for some 15 minutes, there was a commotion among the denizens of the gardens. This died away, and after that all was again quiet. About an hour later, the moon's light showed above the distant horizon. From where I sat, I could see it over the trees, but it was not until it rose clear of them that I could make out any of the details in the garden below. Even then, I could see none of the brutes. Until, happening to crane forward, I saw several of them lying prone up against the wall of the house. What they were doing I could not make out. It was, however, a chance too good to be ignored, and taking aim, I fired at the one directly beneath. There was a shrill scream, and as the smoke cleared away, I saw that it had turned on its back and was writhing feebly. Then it was quiet. The others had disappeared. Immediately after this, I heard a loud squeal in the direction of the pit. It was answered 100 times from every part of the garden. This gave me some notion of the number of the creatures, and I began to feel that the whole affair was becoming even more serious than I had imagined. As I sat there, silent and watchful, the thought came to me, why was all this? What were these things? What did it mean? Then my thoughts flew back to that vision, though even now I doubt whether it was a vision, of the Plain of Silence. What did that mean? I wondered, and that thing in the arena? Ugh! Lastly, I thought of the house I had seen in that faraway place, that house so like this in every detail of external structure that it might have been modeled from it, or this from that. I had never thought of that. At this moment there came another long squeal from the pit, followed a second later by a couple of shorter ones. At once the garden was filled with answering cries. I stood up quickly and looked over the parapet. In the moonlight it seemed as though the shrubberies were alive. They tossed hither and thither as though shaken by a strong, irregular wind, while a continuous rustling and a noise of scampering feet rose up to meet me. Several times I saw the moonlight gleam on running white figures among the bushes, and twice I fired. The second time my shot was answered by a short squeal of pain. A minute later, the gardens lay silent. From the pit came a deep, hoarse babble of swine talk. At times angry cries smote the air, and they would be answered by multitudinous gruntings. It occurred to me that they were holding some kind of a council, perhaps to discuss the problem of entering the house. Also, I thought that they seemed much enraged, probably by my successful shots. It occurred to me that now would be a good time to make a final survey of our defenses. This I proceeded to do at once, visiting the whole of the basement again and examining each of the doors. Luckily, they are all, like the back one, built of solid iron-studded oak. Then I went upstairs to the study. I was more anxious about this door. It is palpably of a more modern make than the others, and though a stout piece of work, it has little of their ponderous strength. I must explain here that there is a small raised lawn on this side of the house, upon which this door opens, the windows of the study being barred on this account. All the other entrances, excepting the great gateway, which is never opened, are in the lower story. End of chapter 6. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 7 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Attack. I spent some time puzzling how to strengthen the study door. Finally, I went down to the kitchen and with some trouble brought up several heavy pieces of timber. These I wedged up slantwise against it from the floor, nailing them top and bottom. For half an hour I worked hard, and at last got it shored to my mind. Then, feeling easier, I resumed my coat, which I had laid aside, and proceeded to attend to one or two matters before returning to the tower. It was whilst thus employed that I heard a fumbling at the door, and the latch was tried. Keeping silence, I waited. Soon I heard several of the creatures outside. They were grunting to one another softly. Then, for a minute, there was quietness. Suddenly there sounded a quick, low grunt, and the door creaked under a tremendous pressure. It would have burst inward but for the supports I had placed. The strain ceased as quickly as it had begun, and there was more talk. Presently one of the things squealed softly, and I heard the sound of others approaching. There was a short confabulation, then again silence, and I realized that they had called several more to assist. Feeling that now was the supreme moment, I stood ready with my rifle presented. If the door gave, I would at least slay as many as possible. Again came the low signal, and once more the door cracked under a huge force. For a minute, perhaps, the pressure was kept up, and I waited, nervously, expecting each moment to see the door come down with a crash. But no, the struts held, and the attempt proved abortive. Then followed more of their horrible grunting talk, and whilst it lasted I thought I distinguished the noise of fresh arrivals. After a long discussion, during which the door was several times shaken, they became quiet once more, and I knew that they were going to make a third attempt to break it down. I was almost in despair. The props had been severely tried in the two previous attacks, and I was sorely afraid that this would prove too much for them. At that moment, like an inspiration, a thought flashed into my troubled brain. Instantly, for it was no time to hesitate, I ran from the room and up stair after stair. This time it was not to one of the towers that I went, but out onto the flat, leaded roof itself. Once there I raced across to the parapet that walls it round and looked down. As I did so I heard the short, grunted signal, and even up there caught the crying of the door under the assault. There was not a moment to lose, and leaning over I aimed quickly and fired. The report rang sharply, and almost blending with it came the loud splud of the bullet striking its mark. From below rose a shrill wail, and the door ceased its groaning. Then, as I took my weight from off the parapet, a huge piece of the stone coping slid from under me and fell with a crash among the disorganized throng beneath. Several horrible shrieks quavered through the night air, and then I heard a sound of scampering feet. Cautiously, I looked over. In the moonlight I could see the great coping stone lying right across the threshold of the door. I thought I saw something under it, several things, white, but I could not be sure. And so a few minutes passed. As I stared, I saw something come round out of the shadow of the house. It was one of the things. It went up to the stone silently and bent down. I was unable to see what it did. In a minute it stood up. It had something in its talons which it put to its mouth and tore at. For the moment I did not realize. Then, slowly, I comprehended. The thing was stooping again. It was horrible. I started to load my rifle. When I looked again, the monster was tugging at the stone, moving it to one side. I leant the rifle on the coping and pulled the trigger. The brute collapsed on its face and kicked slightly. Simultaneously, almost with the report, I heard another sound, that of breaking glass. Waiting only to recharge my weapon, I ran from the roof and down the first two flights of stairs. Here I paused to listen. As I did so, there came another tinkle of falling glass. It appeared to come from the floor below. Excitedly, I sprang down the steps and, guided by the rattle of the window sash, reached the door of one of the empty bedrooms at the back of the house. I thrust it open. The room was but dimly illuminated by the moonlight, most of the light being blotted out by moving figures at the window. Even as I stood, one crawled through into the room. Leveling my weapon, I fired point-blank at it, filling the room with a deafening bang. When the smoke cleared, I saw that the room was empty and the window free. The room was much lighter. The night air blew in coldly through the shattered panes. Down below in the night I could hear a soft moaning and a confused murmur of swine voices. Stepping to one side of the window, I reloaded and then stood there waiting. Presently I heard a scuffling noise. From where I stood in the shadow I could see without being seen. Nearer came the sounds, and then I saw something come up above the sill and clutch at the broken window frame. It caught a piece of the woodwork, and now I could make out that it was a hand and arm. A moment later the face of one of the swine creatures rose into view. Then, before I could use my rifle or do anything, there came a sharp crack, crack, and the window frame gave way under the weight of the thing. Next instant a squashing thud and a loud outcry told me that it had fallen to the ground. With a savage hope that it had been killed, I went to the window. The moon had gone behind a cloud so that I could see nothing, though a steady hum of jabbering just beneath where I stood indicated that there were several more of the brutes close at hand. As I stood there, looking down, I marveled how it had been possible for the creatures to climb so far, for the wall is comparatively smooth, while the distance to the ground must be at least 80 feet. All at once, as I bent, peering, I saw something indistinctly that cut the gray shadow of the house side with a black line. It passed the window to the left, at a distance of about 2 feet. Then I remembered that it was a gutter pipe that had been put there some years ago to carry off the rainwater. I had forgotten about it. I could see now how the creatures had managed to reach the window. Even as the solution came to me, I heard a faint slithering, scratching noise, and I knew that another of the brutes was coming. I waited some odd moments, then leant out of the window and felt the pipe. To my delight, I found that it was quite loose, and I managed, using the rifle barrel as a crowbar, to lever it out from the wall. I worked quickly. Then, taking hold with both hands, I wrenched the whole concern away and hurled it down, with the thing still clinging to it, into the garden. For a few moments longer I waited there listening. But after the first general outcry, I heard nothing. I knew now that there was no more reason to fear an attack from this quarter. I had removed the only means of reaching the window, and as none of the other windows had any adjacent water pipes to tempt the climbing powers of the monsters, I began to feel more confident of escaping their clutches. Leaving the room, I made my way down to the study. I was anxious to see how the door had withstood the test of that last assault. Entering, I lit two of the candles and then turned to the door. One of the large props had been displaced, and on that side the door had been forced inward some 6 inches. It was providential that I had managed to drive the brutes away just when I did. And that coping-stone! I wondered vaguely how I had managed to dislodge it. I had not noticed it loose as I took my shot, and then as I stood up it had slipped away from beneath me. I felt that I owed the dismissal of the attacking force more to its timely fall than to my rifle. Then the thought came that I had better seize this chance to shore up the door again. It was evident that the creatures had not returned since the fall of the coping-stone, but who was to say how long they would keep away? There and then I set to at repairing the door, working hard and anxiously. First I went down to the basement and, rummaging round, found several pieces of heavy oak planking. With these I returned to the study, and having removed the props, placed the planks up against the door. Then I nailed the heads of the struts to these, and driving them well home at the bottoms, nailed them again there. Thus I made the door stronger than ever, for now it was solid with the backing of boards, and would, I felt convinced, stand a heavier pressure than hitherto without giving way. After that I lit the lamp which I had brought from the kitchen, and went down to have a look at the lower windows. Now that I had seen an instance of the strength the creatures possessed, I felt considerable anxiety about the windows on the ground floor, in spite of the fact that they were so strongly barred. I went first to the buttery, having a vivid remembrance of my late adventure there. The place was chilly, and the wind, soughing in through the broken glass, produced an eerie note. Apart from the general air of dismalness, the place was as I had left it the night before. Going up to the window, I examined the bars closely, noting as I did so their comfortable thickness. Still, as I looked more intently, it seemed to me that the middle bar was bent slightly from the straight. Yet it was but trifling, and it might have been so for years. I had never before noticed them particularly. I put my hand through the broken window and shook the bar. It was as firm as a rock. Perhaps the creatures had tried to start it, and finding it beyond their power, ceased from the effort. After that I went round to each of the windows in turn, examining them with careful attention. But nowhere else could I trace anything to show that there had been any tampering. Having finished my survey, I went back to the study and poured myself out a little brandy, then to the tower to watch. End of chapter 7. Recording by John Van Stand, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 8 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. After the attack. It was now about 3 a.m., and presently the eastern sky began to pale with the coming of dawn. Gradually the day came, and by its light I scanned the gardens earnestly. But nowhere could I see any signs of the brutes. I leant over and glanced down to the foot of the wall to see whether the body of the thing I had shot the night before was still there. It was gone. I suppose that others of the monsters had removed it during the night. Then I went down onto the roof and crossed over the gap from which the coping-stone had fallen. Reaching it, I looked over. Yes, there was the stone as I had seen it last, but there was no appearance of anything beneath it, nor could I see the creatures I had killed after its fall. Evidently they had also been taken away. I turned and went down to my study. There I sat down wearily. I was thoroughly tired. It was quite light now, though the sun's rays were not as yet perceptibly hot. A clock chimed the hour of 4. I awoke with a start and looked round hurriedly. The clock in the corner indicated that it was 3 o'clock. It was already afternoon. I must have slept for nearly 11 hours. With a jerky movement, I sat forward in the chair and listened. The house was perfectly silent. Slowly I stood up and yawned. I felt desperately tired still and sat down again, wondering what it was that had waked me. It must have been the clock striking, I concluded presently, and was commencing to doze off when a sudden noise brought me back once more to life. It was the sound of a step, as of a person moving cautiously down the corridor toward my study. In an instant I was on my feet and grasping my rifle. Noiselessly I waited. Had the creatures broken in whilst I slept? Even as I questioned, the steps reached my door, halted momentarily, and then continued down the passage. Silently I tiptoed to the doorway and peeped out. Then I experienced such a feeling of relief as must have reprieved criminal. It was my sister. She was going toward the stairs. I stepped into the hall and was about to call her when it occurred to me that it was very queer she should have crept past my door in that stealthy manner. I was puzzled, and for one brief moment the thought occupied my mind that it was not she, but some fresh mystery of the house. Then, as I caught a glimpse of her old petticoat, the thought passed as quickly as it had come, and I half laughed. There could be no mistaking that ancient garment. Yet I wondered what she was doing, and remembered her condition of mind on the previous day. I felt that it might be best to follow quietly, taking care not to alarm her, and see what she was going to do. If she behaved rationally, well and good. If not, I should have to take steps to restrain her. I could run no unnecessary risks under the danger that threatened us. Quickly I reached the head of the stairs and paused a moment. Then I heard a sound that sent me leaping down at a mad rate. It was the rattle of bolts being unshut. That foolish sister of mine was actually unbarring the back door. Just as her hand was on the last bolt, I reached her. She had not seen me, and the first thing she knew, I had hold of her arm. She glanced up quickly like a frightened animal and screamed aloud. "Come, Mary," I said sternly. "What's the meaning of this nonsense? Do you mean to tell me you don't understand the danger? That you try to throw our two lives away in this fashion?" To this she replied nothing, only trembled violently, gasping and sobbing as though in the last extremity of fear. Through some minutes I reasoned with her, pointing out the need for caution and asking her to be brave. There was little to be afraid of now, I explained, and I tried to believe that I spoke the truth. But she must be sensible, and not attempt to leave the house for a few days. At last I ceased in despair. It was no use talking to her. She was obviously not quite herself for the time being. Finally, I told her she had better go to her room if she could not behave rationally. Still, she took not any notice. So without more ado, I picked her up in my arms and carried her there. At first she screamed wildly, but had relapsed into silent trembling by the time I reached the stairs. Arriving at her room, I laid her upon the bed. She lay there quietly enough, neither speaking nor sobbing, just shaking in a very ague of fear. I took a rug from a chair nearby and spread it over her. I could do nothing more for her, and so crossed to where Pepper lay in a big basket. My sister had taken charge of him since his wound to nurse him, for it had proved more severe than I had thought, and I was pleased to note that, in spite of her state of mind, she had looked after the old dog carefully. Stooping, I spoke to him, and in reply he licked my hand feebly. He was too ill to do more. Then, going to bed, I bent over my sister and asked her how she felt. But she only shook the more, and much as it pained me, I had to admit that my presence seemed to make her worse. And so I left her, locking the door and pocketing the key. It seemed to be the only course to take. The rest of the day I spent between the tower and my study. For food I brought up a loaf from the pantry, and on this, since some claret, I lived for that day. What a long, weary day it was! If only I could have gone out into the gardens, as is my wont. I should have been content enough, but to be cooped in this silent house with no companion save a mad woman and a sick dog was enough to prey upon the nerves of the hardiest. And out in the tangled shrubberies that surrounded the house lurked, for all I could tell, those infernal swine creatures, waiting their chance. Was ever a man in such straits? Once in the afternoon, and again later, I went to visit my sister. The second time I found her tending Pepper, but at my approach she slid over unobtrusively to the far corner with a gesture that saddened me beyond belief. Poor girl! Her fear cut me intolerably, and I would not intrude on her unnecessarily. She would be better, I trusted, in a few days. Meanwhile, I could do nothing, and I judged it still needful, hard as it seemed, to keep her confined to her room. One thing there was that I took for encouragement. She had eaten some of the food I had taken to her on my first visit. And so the day passed. As the evening drew on, the air grew chilly, and I began to make preparations for passing a second night in the tower, taking up two additional rifles and a heavy ulster. The rifles I loaded and laid alongside my other, as I intended to make things warm for any of the creatures who might show during the night. I had plenty of ammunition, and I thought to give the brutes such a lesson as should show them the uselessness of attempting to force an entrance. After that, I made the round of the house again, paying particular attention to the props that supported the study door. Then, feeling that I had done all that lay in my power to ensure our safety, I returned to the tower, calling in on my sister and Pepper for a final visit on the way. Pepper was asleep, but woke as I entered and wagged his tail in recognition. I thought he seemed slightly better. My sister was lying on the bed, though whether asleep or not, I was unable to tell, and thus I left them. Reaching the tower, I made myself as comfortable as circumstances would permit, and settled down to watch through the night. Gradually darkness fell, and soon the details of the gardens were merged into shadows. During the first few hours I sat alert, listening for any sound that might help to tell me if anything were stirring down below. It was far too dark for my eyes to be of much use. Slowly the hours passed without anything unusual happening, and the moon rose, showing the gardens apparently empty and silent, and so through the night without disturbance or sound. Toward morning I began to grow stiff and cold with my long vigil. Also, I was getting very uneasy concerning the continued quietness on the part of the creatures. I mistrusted it, and would sooner, far, have had them attack the house openly. Then at least I should have known my danger and been able to meet it. But to wait like this, through a whole night, picturing all kinds of unknown devilment, was to jeopardize one's sanity. Once or twice the thought came to me that perhaps they had gone. But in my heart I found it impossible to believe that it was so. End of chapter 8. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 9 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. In the Cellars. At last, what with being tired and cold and the uneasiness that possessed me, I resolved to take a walk through the house, first calling in at the study for a glass of brandy to warm me. This I did, and while there I examined the door carefully, but found all as I had left it the night before. The day was just breaking as I left the tower, though it was still too dark in the house to be able to see without a light, and I took one of the study candles with me on my round. By the time I had finished the ground floor, the daylight was creeping in wanly through the barred windows. My search had shown me nothing fresh. Everything appeared to be in order, and I was on the point of extinguishing my candle when the thought suggested itself to me to have another glance round the cellars. I had not, if I remember rightly, been into them since my hasty search on the evening of the attack. For perhaps the half of a minute, I hesitated. I would have been very willing to forego the task, as indeed I am inclined to think any man well might. For all of the great, awe-inspiring rooms in the house, the cellars are the hugest and weirdest. Great gloomy caverns of places, unlit by any ray of daylight. Yet I would not shirk the work. I felt that to do so would smack of sheer cowardice. Besides, as I reassured myself, the cellars were really the most unlikely places in which to come across anything dangerous, considering that they can be entered only through a heavy oaken door, the key of which I carry always on my person. It is in the smallest of these places that I keep my wine, a gloomy hole close to the foot of the cellar stairs, and beyond which I have seldom proceeded. Indeed, save for rummaging round, already mentioned, I doubt whether I had ever before been right through the cellars. As I unlocked the great door at the top of the steps, I paused nervously a moment at the strange, desolate smell that assailed my nostrils. Then, throwing the barrel of my weapon forward, I descended slowly into the darkness of the underground regions. Reaching the bottom of the stairs, I stood for a minute and listened. All was silent, save for a faint drip-drip of water, falling drop by drop somewhere to my left. As I stood, I noticed how quietly the candle burnt. Never a flicker nor flare, so utterly windless was the place. Quietly I moved from cellar to cellar. I had but a very dim memory of their arrangement. The impressions left by my first search were blurred. I had recollections of a succession of great cellars, and of one greater than the rest, the roof of which was upheld by pillars. Beyond that, my mind was hazy, and predominated by a sense of cold and darkness and shadows. Now, however, it was different, for, although nervous, I was sufficiently collected to be able to look about me and note the structure and size of the different vaults I entered. Of course, with the amount of light given by my candle, it was not possible to examine each place minutely, but I was enabled to notice as I went along that the walls appeared to be built with wonderful precision and finish, while here and there an occasional massive pillar shot up to support the vaulted roof. Thus I came at last to the great cellar that I remembered. It is reached through a huge arched entrance, on which I observed strange fantastic carvings, which threw queer shadows under the light of my candle. As I stood and examined these thoughtfully, it occurred to me how strange it was that I should be so little acquainted with my own house. Yet this may be easily understood when one realizes the size of this ancient pile, and the fact that only my old sister and I live in it, occupying a few of the rooms such as our wants decide. Holding the light high, I passed on into the cellar, and, keeping to the right, paced slowly up until I reached the further end. I walked quietly, and looked cautiously about as I went. But, so far as the light showed, I saw nothing unusual. At the top I turned to the left, still keeping to the wall, and so continued, until I had traversed the whole of the vast chamber. As I moved along, I noticed that the floor was composed of solid rock, in places covered with a damp mold, and others bare, or almost so, save for a thin coating of light gray dust. I had halted at the doorway. Now, however, I turned and made my way up to the center of the place, passing among the pillars and glancing to right and left as I moved. About halfway up the cellar, I stubbed my foot against something that gave out a metallic sound. Stooping quickly, I held the candle and saw that the object I had kicked was a large metal ring. Bending lower, I cleared the dust from around it and presently discovered that it was attached to a ponderous trap door, black with age. Feeling excited and wondering to where it could lead, I laid my gun on the floor and, sticking the candle in the trigger guard, took the ring in both hands and pulled. The trap creaked loudly, the sound echoing vaguely through the huge place, and opened heavily. Propping the edge on my knee, I reached for the candle and held it in the opening, moving it to right and left, but could see nothing. I was puzzled and surprised. There were no signs of steps, nor even the appearance of there ever having been any. Nothing save an empty blackness. I might have been looking down into a bottomless, sideless well. Then, even as I stared, full of perplexity, I seemed to hear, far down, as though from untold depths, a faint whisper of sound. I bent my head quickly more into the opening and listened intently. It may have been fancy, but I could have sworn to hearing a soft titter that grew into a hideous chuckling, faint and distant. Startled, I leapt backward, letting the trap fall with a hollow clang that filled the place with echoes. Even then I seemed to hear that mocking, suggestive laughter. but this I knew must be my imagination. The sound I had heard was far too slight to penetrate through the cumbrous trap. For a full minute I stood there quivering, glancing nervously behind and before, but the great cellar was silent as a grave, and gradually I shook off the frightened sensation. With a calmer mind I became again curious to know into what that trap opened, but could not then summon sufficient courage to make a further investigation. One thing I felt, however, was that the trap ought to be secured. This I accomplished by placing upon it several large pieces of dressed stone, which I had noticed in my tour along the east wall. Then, after a final scrutiny of the rest of the place, I retraced my way through the cellars to the stairs, and so reached the daylight. With an infinite feeling of relief that the uncomfortable task was accomplished. End of chapter 9. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 10 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Time of Waiting. The sun was now warm and shining brightly, forming a wondrous contrast to the dark and dismal cellars, and it was with comparatively light feelings that I made my way up to the tower to survey the gardens. There I found everything quiet, and after a few minutes went down to Mary's room. Here, having knocked and received a reply, I unlocked the door. My sister was sitting quietly on the bed, as though waiting. She seemed quite herself again, and made no attempt to move away as I approached. Yet I observed that she scanned my face anxiously, as though in doubt, and but half assured in her mind that there was nothing to fear from me. To my questions as to how she felt, she replied, sanely enough, that she was hungry and would like to go down to prepare breakfast if I did not mind. For a minute I meditated whether it would be safe to let her out. Finally I told her she might go, on condition that she promised not to attempt to leave the house, or meddle with any of the outer doors. At my mention of the doors, a sudden look of fright crossed her face, but she said nothing save to give the required promise, and then left the room silently. Crossing the floor, I approached Pepper. He had waked as I entered, but, beyond a slight yelp of pleasure and a soft rapping with his tail, had kept quiet. Now, as I patted him, he made an attempt to stand up and succeeded, only to fall back on his side with a little yowl of pain. I spoke to him and bade him lie still. I was greatly delighted with his improvement, and also with the natural kindness of my sister's heart, in taking such good care of him, and in spite of her condition of mind. After a while I left him and went downstairs to my study. In a little time Mary appeared, carrying a tray on which smoked a hot breakfast. As she entered the room I saw her gaze fasten on the props that supported the study door. Her lips tightened, and I thought she paled slightly, but that was all. Putting the tray down at my elbow, she was leaving the room quietly when I called her back. She came, it seemed, a little timidly, as though startled, and I noted that her hand clutched at her apron nervously. "Come, Mary," I said. "Cheer up. Things look brighter. I've seen none of the creatures since yesterday morning, early." She looked at me in a curiously puzzled manner, as though not comprehending. Then intelligence swept into her eyes and fear. But she said nothing beyond an unintelligible murmur of acquiescence. After that I kept silence. It was evident that any reference to the swine things was more than her shaken nerves could bear. Breakfast over, I went up to the tower. Here, during the greater part of the day, I maintained a strict watch over the gardens. Once or twice I went down to the basement to see how my sister was getting along. Each time I found her quiet and curiously submissive. Indeed, on the last occasion she even ventured to address me on her own account with regard to some household matter that needed attention. Though this was done with an almost extraordinary timidity, I hailed it with happiness as being the first word voluntarily spoken since the critical moment when I had caught her unbarring the back door to go out among those waiting brutes. I wondered whether she was aware of her attempt, and how near a thing it had been, but refrained from questioning her, thinking it best to let well alone. That night I slept in a bed, the first time for 2 nights. In the morning I rose early and took a walk through the house. All was as it should be, and I went up to the tower to have a look at the gardens. Here again I found perfect quietness. At breakfast, when I met Mary, I was greatly pleased to see that she had sufficiently regained command over herself to be able to greet me in a perfectly natural manner. She talked sensibly and quietly, only keeping carefully from any mention of the past couple of days. In this I humored her to the extent of not attempting to lead the conversation in that direction. Earlier in the morning I had been to see Pepper. He was mending rapidly and bade fair to be on his legs, in earnest, in another day or two. Before leaving the breakfast table I made some reference to his improvement. In the short discussions that followed I was surprised to gather from my sister's remarks that she was still under the impression that his wound had been given by the wildcat of my invention. It made me feel almost ashamed of myself for deceiving her. Yet the lie had been told to prevent her from being frightened. And then I had been sure that she must have known the truth later when those brutes had attacked the house. During the day I kept on alert, spending much of my time as on the previous day in the tower. But not a sign could I see of the swine creatures, nor hear any sound. Several times the thought had come to me that the things had, at last, left us. But, up to this time, I had refused to entertain the idea seriously. Now, however, I began to feel that there was reason for hope. It would soon be 3 days since I had seen any of the things. But still I intended to use the utmost caution. For all that I could tell, this protracted silence might be a ruse to tempt me from the house, perhaps right into their arms. The thought of such contingency was alone sufficient to make me circumspect. So it was that the 4th, 5th, and 6 days went by quietly without my making any attempt to leave the house. On the 6th day, I had the pleasure of seeing Pepper once more upon his feet, and though still very weak, he managed to keep me company during the whole of that day. End of chapter 10. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 11 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Searching of the Gardens. How slowly the time went, and never a thing to indicate that any of the brutes still infested the gardens. It was on the 9th day that finally I decided to run the risk, if any there were, and sally out. With this purpose in view, I loaded one of the shotguns carefully, choosing it as being more deadly than a rifle at close quarters, and then, after a final scrutiny of the grounds from the tower, I called Pepper to follow me, and made my way down to the basement. At the door I must confess to hesitating a moment. The thought of what might be awaiting me among the dark shrubberies was by no means calculated to encourage my resolution. It was but a second, though, and then I had drawn the bolts, and was standing on the path outside the door. Pepper followed, stopping at the doorstep to sniff suspiciously, and carrying his nose up and down the jambs as though following a scent. Then suddenly he turned sharply and started to run here and there in semicircles and circles all around the door, finally returning to the threshold. Here he began again to nose about. Hitherto I had stood watching the dog, yet all the time with half my gaze on the wild tangle of gardens stretching round me. Now I went toward him and, bending down, examined the surface of the door where he was smelling. I found that the wood was covered with a network of scratches, crossing and recrossing one another in inextricable confusion. In addition to this, I noticed that the doorposts themselves were gnawed in places. Beyond these I could find nothing, and so, standing up, I began to make the tour of the house wall. Pepper, as soon as I walked away, left the door and ran ahead, still nosing and sniffing as he went along. At times he stopped to investigate. He Here it would be a bullet hole in the pathway, or perhaps a powder-stained wad. Anon it might be a piece of torn sod or a disturbed patch of weedy path, but save for such trifles he found nothing. I observed him critically as he went along, and could discover nothing of uneasiness in his demeanor to indicate that he felt the nearness of any of the creatures. By this I was assured that the gardens were empty, at least for the present, of those hateful things. Pepper could not be easily deceived, and it was a relief to feel that he would know, and give me timely warning if there were any danger. Reaching the place where I had shot that first creature, I stopped and made a careful scrutiny, but could see nothing. From there I went on to where the great coping-stone had fallen. It lay on its side, apparently just as it had been left when I shot the brute that was moving it. A couple of feet to the right of the nearer end was a great dent in the ground, showing where it had struck. The other end was still within the indentation, half in and half out. Going nearer, I looked at the stone more closely. What a huge piece of masonry it was! And that creature had moved it single-handed in its attempt to reach what lay below. I went round to the further end of the stone. Here I found that it was possible to see under it for a distance of nearly a couple of feet. Still, I could see nothing of the stricken creatures, and I felt much surprised. I had, as I have before said, guessed that the remains had been removed. Yet I could not conceive that it had been done so thoroughly as not to leave some certain sign beneath the stone indicative of their fate. I had seen several of the brutes struck down beneath it with such force that they must have been literally driven into the earth. And now, not a vestige of them was to be seen, not even a blood stain. I felt more puzzled than ever as I turned the matter over in my mind, but could think of no plausible explanation, and so finally gave it up as one of the many things that were unexplainable. From there I transferred my attention to the study door. I could see now even more plainly the effects of the tremendous strain to which it had been subjected, and I marveled how, even with the support afforded by the props, it had withstood the attack so well. There were no marks of blows, indeed, none had been given, but the door had been literally riven from its hinges by the application of enormous, silent force. One thing that I observed affected me profoundly. The head of one of the props had been driven right through a panel. This was of itself sufficient to show how huge an effort the creatures had made to break down the door and how nearly they had succeeded. Leaving, I continued my tour round the house, finding little else of interest, save at the back, where I came across the piece of piping I had torn from the wall lying among the long grass underneath the broken window. Then I returned to the house, and having rebolted the back door, went up to the tower. Here I spent the afternoon reading and occasionally glancing down into the gardens. I had determined, if the night passed quietly, to go as far as the pit on the morrow. Perhaps I should be able to learn then something of what had happened. The day slipped away, and the night came and went much as the last few nights had gone. When I rose, the morning had broken fine and clear, and I determined to put my project into action. During breakfast I considered the matter carefully, after which I went to the study for my shotgun. In addition, I loaded and slipped into my pocket a small but heavy pistol. I quite understood that if there were any danger it lay in the direction of the pit, and I intended to be prepared. Leaving the study, I went down to the back door, followed by Pepper. Once outside, I took a quick survey of the surrounding gardens and then set off toward the pit. On the way, I kept a sharp outlook, holding my gun handily. Pepper was running ahead, I noticed, without any apparent hesitation. From this, I augured that there was no imminent danger to be apprehended, and I stepped out more quickly in his wake. He had reached the top of the pit now and was nosing his way along the edge. A moment later, I was beside him, looking down into the pit. For a moment I could scarcely believe that it was the same place, so greatly was it changed. The dark, wooded ravine of a fortnight ago, with a foliage-hidden stream running sluggishly at the bottom, existed no longer. Instead, my eyes showed me a ragged chasm, partly filled with a gloomy lake of turbid water. All one side of the ravine was stripped of underwood, showing the bare rock. A little to my left, the side of the pit appeared to have collapsed altogether, forming a deep V-shaped cleft in the face of the rocky cliff. This rift ran from the upper edge of the ravine nearly down to the water, and penetrated into the pit side to a distance of some 40 feet. Its opening was at least 6 yards across, and from this it seemed to taper into about 2. But what attracted my attention more than ever, the stupendous split itself, was a great hole, some distance down the cleft and right in the angle of the V. It was clearly defined and not unlike an arched doorway in shape, though, lying as it did in the shadow, I could not see it very distinctly. The opposite side of the pit still retained its verdure, but so torn in places, and everywhere covered with dust and rubbish, that it was hardly distinguishable as such. My first impression, that there had been a landslip, was, I begin to see, not sufficient, of itself, to account for all the changes I witnessed. And the water. I turned suddenly, for I had become aware that somewhere to my right there was a noise of running water. I could see nothing, but now that my attention had been caught, I distinguished easily that it came from somewhere at the east end of the pit. Slowly I made my way in that direction, the sound growing plainer as I advanced, until in a little I stood right above it. Even then I could not perceive the cause until I knelt down and thrust my head over the cliff. Here the noise came up to me plainly, and I saw below me a torrent of clear water issuing from a small fissure in the pit side, and rushing down the rocks into the lake beneath. A little further along the cliff I saw another, and beyond that again two smaller ones. These, then, would help to account for the quantity of water in the pit. And if the fall of rock and earth had blocked the outlet of the stream at the bottom, there was little doubt but that it was contributing a very large share. Yet I puzzled my head to account for the generally shaken appearance of the place, these streamlets and that huge cleft further up the ravine. It seemed to me that more than the landslip was necessary to account for these. I could imagine an earthquake, or a great explosion creating some such condition of affairs as existed, but of these there had been neither. Then I stood up quickly, remembering that crash, and the cloud of dust that had followed directly, rushing high into the air. But I shook my head unbelievingly. No, it must have been the noise of the falling rocks and earth I had heard of. Of course, the dust would fly, naturally. Still, in spite of my reasoning, I had an uneasy feeling that this theory did not satisfy my sense of the probable. And yet, was any other that I could suggest likely to be half so plausible? Pepper had been sitting on the grass while I conducted my examination. Now, as I turned up the north side of the ravine, he rose and followed. Slowly, and keeping a careful watch in all directions, I made the circuit of the pit, but found little else that I had not already seen. From the west end, I could see the 4 waterfalls uninterruptedly. They were some considerable distance up from the surface of the lake, about 50 feet, I calculated. For a little while longer I loitered about, keeping my eyes and ears open, but still without seeing or hearing anything suspicious. The whole place was wonderfully quiet. Indeed, save for the continuous murmur of the water at the top end, no sound of any description broke the silence. All this while Pepper had shown no signs of uneasiness. This seemed to me to indicate that for the time being, at least, there was none of the swine creatures in the vicinity. So far as I could see, his attention appeared to have been taken chiefly with scratching and sniffing among the grass at the edge of the pit. At times he would leave the edge and run along toward the house, as though following invisible tracks, but in all cases returning after a few minutes. I had little doubt but that he was really tracing out the footsteps of the swine things, and the very fact that each one seemed to lead him back to the pit appeared to me a proof that the brutes had all returned whence they came. At noon I went home for dinner. During the afternoon I made a partial search of the gardens accompanied by Pepper, but without coming upon anything to indicate the presence of the creatures. Once, as we made our way through the shrubberies, Pepper rushed in among some bushes with a fierce yelp. At that I jumped back in sudden fright and threw my gun forward in readiness, only to laugh nervously as Pepper reappeared chasing an unfortunate cat. Toward evening I gave up the search and returned to the house. All at once, as we were passing a great clump of bushes on our right, Pepper disappeared, and I could hear him sniffing and growling among them in a suspicious manner. With my gun barrel I parted the intervening shrubbery and looked inside. There was nothing to be seen save that many of the branches were bent down and broken, as though some animal had made a lair there at no very previous date. It was probably, I thought, one of the places occupied by some of the swine creatures on the night of the attack. Next day I resumed my search through the gardens, but without result. By evening I had been right through them, and now I knew, beyond the possibility of doubt, that there were no longer any of the things concealed about the place. Indeed, I have often thought since that I was correct in my earlier surmise, that they had left soon after the attack. End of chapter 11. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only. Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.